From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Some people will risk it all to help others.
He just did what came natural to him and covered the person closest to him and shielded her from a lot of bullets.
We spend a lot of time trying to understand why a person would do awful things, but what about the people who do selfless, heroic things? That discussion is later. First, though, we talked last week about the latest album from Atlanta-based rapper Gucci Mane.
He's kind of talking about the ways that we like to flirt with danger, right? And he's asking, what is it that attracts us to the dark side? And he's asking, and he's posing this question to himself, but he's also using illustrations of, you know, be it fans or, you know, people that he comes across, or, you know, being a former drug dealer and, you know, that whole lifestyle and how attractive it can be sometimes.
I make them shoot you clean in your dad head. Hit you with your trap and shoot you clean out your haircut. Everybody
wanna be. That's NPR's hip-hop reporter Rodney Carmichael. Here are your first thoughts. Matt Mickelveen writes, Gucci Mane was incarcerated for having loaded firearms as an already convicted felon, and then you celebrate and praise his music as if he is some type of hero? This is days after a U.S. lawmaker was critically wounded by a gun, and our country is trying to tone down the rhetoric. Rap music glorifies guns, and young people are paying attention. One more point. Last week, the two felons who escaped were caught by a homeowner and held at gunpoint until authorities arrived. I'm glad he had a gun. We always love to get your thoughts, even when they're critiques. Call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter or Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Today is World Refugee Day. It's observed every year on June 20th. Clarkston, Georgia, is home to a very large refugee population. It's been called the Ellis Island of the South. Following President Trump's executive orders concerning immigrants and refugees, the city held a special meeting. Clarkston resident Amina Osman spoke at the meeting. She's originally from Somalia. She lost her husband and children to that country's civil war, and she had this message for President Trump.
I love America. But I feel bad today. Muslims and Christians was created by God. When God loves his people, you are not supposed to judge. He's not supposed to judge. He's not supposed to just divide us today between Christian and Muslim. One day, he will answer from God.
Amina Osman is one of many refugees who have made Clarkston home. Ted Terry is the mayor of Clarkston, and I spoke to him back in January.
The census has us at about half of our city is foreign-born, and we're up about 13,000 people total in our 1.4-square-mile city.
And it's been called the most diverse square mile in America based on census records. Give me an idea of how many countries we're talking about.
That's right. Yes, 40 different nationalities, 60 different languages. We've been receiving refugees since the Refugee Act of 1980, and so we still have Vietnamese now citizens who still live in Clarkston, who came over way back in the early 1980s, Somalia, Sudan, Ethiopia. You can chart the course of human events and world events through the people that have come to Clarkston, all the way up to Iraqi, Afghani, and now Syrian refugees.
And so this executive order may, in fact, affect a large number of people in Clarkston.
That's right. Well, so the number one, the local economy is completely dependent upon the international clientele. So we don't have large supermarket chains or department stores. We have local grocery stores, ethnic eateries, people who do business around the world who still have ties back to their home countries. And so two parts, the travel ban is going to affect some local businesses. But then long term, the bringing the cap from 110,000 refugees under President Obama to down to 50,000 refugees under President Trump is going to have a big effect on our apartment complexes. The resettlement agencies fill nearly 1,000 vacant apartment units every year in Clarkston. And you know, the reality is that a large part of the economy is based around the MARTA cards, the rent, the utilities, the money spent at grocery stores by refugees in those initial 3 to 4 months. And then the good news is that after 180 days, 91% of these refugees are self-sufficient. So they have a job, they're learning English, their kids are enrolled in school. Hopefully they've paid back their plane ticket, which they came over here on, and they're part of our community.
Is there a particular problem with I guess, strengthening the vetting process for refugees in your mind?
Well, under President George W. Bush, after the 9/11 attacks, the refugee program went through a major overhaul, and so the vetting processes were strengthened significantly. And under President Obama, Syrian refugees went through an entire other layer of vetting called the Syria Enhanced Review. And these were programs and vetting that were put forth not by a political team under President Obama, they're put forth by the Department of Homeland Security, by the CIA, by the FBI, presumably the experts. And so I'm not sure how much more vetting is going to happen. It sounds a little bit political. When I hear the most dangerous countries in the world, I think, well, why wouldn't Saudi Arabia be on that list? That's where most of the hijackers came who attacked us on 9/11.
Okay. What is the crime rate in Clarkston?
So in the past few years, we've been ranked one of the 50 safest cities in Georgia. We fell off a little bit recently, but there's 500 cities in Georgia, and being in the top 50 or top 60, so I think is pretty good.
What kind of calls are you getting? What kind of things are you hearing from your constituents?
Well, I think, for the most part, folks want to know, is Clarkston going to continue to be a welcoming and compassionate community?
Are they worried about traveling and being able to get back into the U.S.?
We have some folks who have been in this country for decades, from Somalia and Sudan, who have business ties back in those countries, who travel to those countries to visit, extended family. And so, I think in the short term, they're going to, be impacted by it.
So what do you need to do as the mayor at this point? Are you clear on exactly what this executive order does?
I am when it comes to the future impact on refugee resettlement. If we're cutting the refugee resettlement in half, we're talking about a major hit to our economy.
More than half.
And I've gotten a lot of comments from just sort of the social media sphere about, we need to be, housing homeless vets instead of refugees, to which I've argued that those are not mutually exclusive, goals. And that if we really want to kind of get down to what are we paying for and what's more valuable, I would argue that $1 billion spent on an artillery system that no one wants is not going to keep us safe from terrorists. However, the dividend, the compassionate dividend extended by America to rescue just a small drop in the sea of humanity. 16 million people are in refugee status, which means they have left their home and their country and are in limbo. Another 60 million people are internally displaced. And we're talking about 10,000 Syrians, 16,000 people from the Democratic Republic of Congo, which, by the way, if we really want to talk about the other humanitarian crisis in this country, in this world, it's conflict minerals that are being used to build our iPhones. And that's another huge aspect of the refugee crisis, which will be affected, bringing that cap down to 50,000.
So some polls have been taken, and a large number of the Americans who support a travel ban like this don't have personal interactions with either refugees or, in fact, Muslims. So what would you say to somebody like that who might feel fear before they ever moved into a place like Clarkston?
Yeah, one of the calls I got in my office was from a gentleman who lives south of Atlanta, and he said that, Mayor, I'm concerned that we're going to have Sharia law in Clarkston, in Georgia, if we don't stop all these refugees. And I had to tell him, straight out, as long as I'm mayor, we will respect the Constitution and we will not have Sharia law in my city. And
is there a danger of having Sharia law?
I don't know. This gentleman was concerned about it, but when he heard me say that we will not have Sharia law in Clarkston, he said, well, I really appreciate you saying that. I was really concerned. And then, I've extended an invitation to him and many other people to visit Clarkston. I think if you would meet people face to face, hear their stories, you will understand that there are a lot of Muslims and just refugees in general who, through no fault of their own, no ill intention for this country, have nothing but love and compassion in their hearts. And because we have rescued them, they see America as the greatest nation on earth. And that's exactly the type of people we want to have in our country. And that's exactly the kind of resident I want to have in my city.
So how do you make it work, though? One of the things that we have seen in the past couple years, at least, it is very difficult to have people from different backgrounds with different perspectives and different life experiences and very different opinions to live near one another without arguing and getting in conflict. So that kind of describes Clarkston, I think, a diversity of opinions, a diversity of perspectives. How do you make that work?
I don't make it work. It's worked on its own. 35 years of refugee resettlement, people from Vietnam, from Bosnia, from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Burma, Bhutan, the Congo. We have a mosque across the streets, a Buddhist temple, down the streets, a Baptist church. Around the corner is an Ethiopian Orthodox church, a Hindu Buddhist temple, all within 1 square mile. And yet no instances of domestic terror, no religious wars, no ethnic conflicts. And so I haven't done anything. I think Clarkston, just as a community, has proven that people can peacefully coexist in the land of liberty.
That is Ted Terry. He is the mayor of Clarkston, Georgia. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We recently visited two people who came to the U.S. as legal Syrian refugees. One left that country before its civil war erupted, the other after. Besides calling Syria their birthplace, they share an even greater bond.
My name is Heval Mohammed Kelly, and I'm 34 years old. I moved to the United States 2 weeks after 9/11/2001.
My name is Aroj Youssef. I am 12 years old, and I am a Syrian refugee. I have been in America about 1 year and 4 months. I do still have friends in Syria, and I miss them, but in Syria there is war, so they cannot come here. But America is better because it is safe and it is a good place to live in.
When I came to the family to visit the first time, I met Nehruz, and I was extremely impressed by her intelligence and her ability to try to speak English and welcoming people and trying to do really well in school. And I think I looked at a report, it was all A's, and she was only here like, 6 months maybe.
He just asked me which grade I am and what I want to be, if I want to study, and all of those questions. I want to become a doctor in my future because I want to help all of the children in the world.
You know, and thank God, like Nehruz right now, she wants to be a doctor. I had a dream when I was 18, wanted to be a doctor, and now I'm a cardiology fellow. One block across from the same place I used to wash dishes when I came to this country, and now I'm a cardiology fellow at the Emory University. When I came here, I was 18. My mom couldn't find a job because she didn't speak English. My brother was too young, and my dad was too sick to work. So I had the ability to work hard and wash dishes for 30 hours a week to support my family and study hard. What I see in her is that she's doing everything she can to get the highest grade possible so she could become something one day and serve her family. So I see the same inspiration in her. She actually inspires me how hard she studies to be better in this country.
I want to help my family learn English or something else. In 1 year, I want to study very, very hard and be talking like Americans. And I'm gonna tell the people who just came to America that I hope they're gonna be nice to people and they're gonna make America better too.
That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. Just ahead, everyone has a hero. Who's yours? First, though, an Athens singer-songwriter adds two more tunes to our Georgia playlist. This is On Second Thought.
We carried on, we carried books.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Climate change affects everyone, but it disproportionately hurts communities of color. An Atlanta-based organization has gotten $1 million from the MacArthur Foundation to help bridge that gap. Nathaniel Smith is the founder and chief equity officer for the Partnership for Southern Equity. Hi, Nathaniel.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. And also joining us to talk about why people of color are more likely to suffer from climate change is Felicia Davis, sustainability coordinator at Clark Atlanta University. Hi, Felicia.
Good morning.
Felicia, let's go straight to that question. Why would climate change, which affects every human on the planet, have a harsher impact on people of color?
Well, primarily it's because of income inequities. And if you would think about a simple thing like a heat wave, And a heat wave doesn't affect most of us because we have air conditioning. But imagine just a normal hot day in Georgia and no air conditioning. For elderly, senior people, fixed income people without resources, that's a very catastrophic impact that can lead to death. And then if you look at things like storms, Katrina was the poster child for climate change. And you can see that people that had resources were able to evacuate. People who didn't were present, and some 1,500 people actually perished in the storm. Then if you look 10 years later, some of those people, 100,000 low-income African Americans, have not returned to the city. So they are just dispersed. And if we look at what was our response to the storm, there's really not even any follow-up. So low-income, vulnerable people of color who have suffered income disparities for generations are hardest hit.
So then what she's explaining, Nathaniel, is almost less about a person's skin color, and it is about fighting poverty. How do you do that?
Well, you know, I think it's difficult, first of all, to separate poverty from race. We know that our history of racial inequity in the South in particular has created a situation where low-wealth communities and communities of color have faced major economic burdens as well as environmental burdens as a result of that. And so because of that fact, communities of color, when other communities get a cold, we get pneumonia. And the energy burden and the challenges associated with climate change are a prime example of that. And so while energy challenges, of course, don't necessarily pick as a result of race who has the most challenges or who are the most burdened, because of our history in this country of racial inequity, the energy challenges that we face are exacerbated in communities of color.
But then how do you address that? I don't mean to interrupt you, but you're talking about something that goes back generations and just is really difficult to face. I'm not saying it's impossible to solve. I'm saying it's really hard. So regardless of how much money that you got from the MacArthur Foundation, how do you begin to address that?
Well, first, what you have to do is begin the process of engaging and empowering communities of color to understand how the energy burdens and the challenges that we face in community can be influenced by them being engaged in the decision-making process around the distribution and the benefits associated with the energy production. There are key opportunities for communities to be heard, like the Public Service Commission. Where are their dollars going as it pertains to utility costs? And even more important, you know, as we move away from a primarily extractive economy into a more energy efficient and sustainable economy.
Extractive means pulling coal,
right,
and
coal,
and oil out of
coal,
the ground.
Yeah, coal and the traditional ways that we generate energy into a cleaner economy, which is primarily focused, of course, on wind and solar and other sustainable matters, that we actually have an opportunity to create an economy that is not only lucrative, but also inclusive and just. So it's about preparing these populations for the new economy that is emerging, to not just be proud that we have solar panels on homes, but how can we actually use workforce development strategies to prepare communities that have been left behind so long for by our economy to lay those solar panels?
Felicia, you wanted to jump in here.
Absolutely. I think when it comes to inequality, I also work with some millennials with the HBCU Green Fund, and they argue that institutions, if you look at well-endowed institutions, be their foundations like Rockefellers and Fords
or MacArthur
or Ivy League, et cetera, that have large, large endowments. We're suggesting that they have to invest. So not just give away or not just make grants, but they have to invest in these communities and in particular in historically Black colleges and universities and do things that are green. So if we actually retrofit our institutions, that will send a message that reverberates throughout the community. You'll have well-educated people that have sustainable lifestyles that take that out into the community. But without that wealth kind of redistribution,
right,
you just never overcome the gap.
And it becomes even more complicated by the political discussion. So let's hear a little bit of that. Here is President Trump talking about withdrawing from the Paris Agreement.
Therefore, in order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
And for the opposing opinion, here is U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer reacting.
Pulling out of the Paris Agreement doesn't put America first. It puts America alone and last. It puts America last in recognizing science, in being a world leader in protecting our own communities, and working in concert with the family of nations in safeguarding the planet we all inhabit for future generations.
So, Nathaniel, what is already a difficult task is made more complicated by the fact that climate change is not necessarily just about science, it's about politics. How do you grapple with that?
Yeah, it is. And unfortunately, it is the politics on many occasions that can get in the way of good public policy. And recently, I elevated, how close Trump's, in the op-ed that I wrote, how close Trump's decision mirrors the decisions of past champions of Jim Crow in the late 60s who fought against a new tomorrow, similar to, again, George Wallace standing in front of the University of Alabama and minimizing and promoting the idea of segregation. Again, what we see is an old way of looking at our economy and our future that is actually minimizing not only our ability to be more competitive in this emerging global economy, but even more so from our perspective, minimizing opportunities for untapped communities and communities that have been suffering and marginalized to actually have a chance to be involved and be at the front of the line when the opportunities associated with a clean energy economy emerge.
So then let me put that to you. And before I do, let's hear one more comment here. This is from a video put together by the UN Development Program on Women and Climate Change.
The impact is particularly acute for women, who make up a large number of the poor communities that depend on natural resources for their livelihood. Successful action on climate change depends on engaging women as stakeholders and planners.
So we only have about a minute left, but Felicia, but how then do you begin to grapple when it is so politicized with?
So I'm just reflecting. I worked for more than a decade with an international group of women called Gender CC, Women for Climate Justice. And all around the world, women are on the front line. And what we have to do here and now is just to keep moving forward. We have someone, when you don't embrace science, there's nothing that I know to be done about that in the scientific arena. So if you have 99% of scientists around the world saying that this, in fact, is real, and we have impacts on women and children around the world, it's time for us to respond, whether it's in the U.S. or globally. So we're out, our leadership is out of step. But the rest of us, not only do we follow the science, we have to learn the science, understand the science, and that will eliminate the opportunity for leaders to misdirect the public.
That's Felicia Davis, Sustainability Coordinator at Clark Atlanta University, and Nathaniel Smith is Founder and Chief Equity Officer for the Partnership for Southern Equity. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now let's add a couple more songs to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to pick the best songs from or about Georgia. And the rules are simple. All tunes have to be written or performed by a Georgian, and artists can't pick one of their own songs. All this week, we feature songs chosen by musicians who are performing at Athfest this weekend. T. Hardy Morris is an Athens-based singer-songwriter, and here are his picks.
Hi, this is T. Hardy Morris, Georgia musician, songwriter. I live in Athens, Georgia, but I grew up in and around Augusta, Georgia. So my first pick is a song by James Brown and the Fabulous Flames called Try Me. The vocal take on this is pretty heart-wrenchingly awesome. Whenever I hear James Brown, I can't help but think about his smile. You would always see him around town pretty often. My first job growing up, I worked at a dry cleaner, and he and his cronies would come in with just mountains of James's wardrobe to be dry cleaning. So it was pretty cool to see him around town a lot growing up. Certainly can't emulate it or sing as well as James, but just listening to someone convey the lyrics as perfectly as he does, and all the cracking and, you know, perfect mistakes within his voice, just kind of really set the whole thing off. James's voice, he could sing the phone book, but it's very pleading and earnest, and I don't know, he just has that delivery, and this song's a perfect example of that, of his ability to get inside and make any song sound pretty much amazing. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is an artist from Atlanta, Georgia, that I actually only recently found out about a little less than a year ago, named Robert Lester Folsom. I don't know much about him, and there's actually not a lot about him out there, but it's a song called See You Later. That's kind of an exemplary track of everything he does. It's just nice, spacey country strangeness that I guess kind of existed in obscurity for a long time. And then I've been listening to it a lot over the past several months as I was leading up to recording a new record. It's pretty stripped down. It's kind of lo-fi. It sounds like it all might have just been on a four track. I'm not sure if there was a full band or if he just played everything, but it sounds really raw and haunting. And that track kind of really speaks to, I guess, the mystique of him as an artist, because you don't know much about him and you don't know where he wound up. And so the song See You Later seems kind of fitting for him. Thank you. I love the sparse drums, kind of Bob Dylan Desire style drums, but recorded much less professionally. You know, he feels kind of like a strange lost Graham Parsons or something with much longer hair. When you listen to his songs, some of it seems like it could be cleaned up and could have been done in Nashville or something, but he was probably smoking a bunch of stuff, and so it wound up like that.
That's Athens musician T. Hardy Morris. He'll perform for AthFest at the Caledonia Lounge this Friday night at 1 a.m. Hope you're a night owl. If you have a song you want to put on the playlist, we would love to hear about it. Call us at 404-500-9457, and you can leave a message and sing a little bit of it. You can also find the entire Georgia playlist series, along with all the great music segments we've done, at gpbnews.org. Just ahead, what makes a hero? We have some answers. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This month marks a year and a half since the deadly mass shooting in San Bernardino, California. The two attackers were killed after they gunned down 14 people. Georgia native Shannon Johnson, a graduate of Macon's Windsor Academy, was one of them. He died shielding a co-worker in the attack. His former fiancée, Mandy Pfeiffer, spoke to NPR in December.
He just did what came natural to him and covered the person closest to him and shielded her from a lot of bullets. You know, when they got down, in his low southern drawl, he just said, you know, I got you. It was just natural.
But friends of the family say Johnson's heroics were in his DNA. His father died years earlier trying to save a coworker during a factory incident. And Rob Johnson, Shannon's brother, joins us now. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Celeste, how are you?
I'm doing well. How old were you when your father passed away?
10.
And tell me the story of how he died.
It was a work-related accident. To make it, I can go on. I'm a storyteller myself. But basically, in nuts and bolts of it, a safety inspector was on the premises, and they got word that he was in trouble. He was down in one of those industrial tanks that are about 12 feet down. You have to take the ladder down. He got overcome by some poisonous gas fumes. My dad took it upon himself to go down there and try to rescue the guy. There was no safety equipment on the premises, and as everybody's looking on, my dad, he's about 150 pounds, 5'8". The guy's trying to fireman's carry up the ladder is about 200, they said 210, something like that, and it just was too much for him. They said he sat the body down, came back up, went back down, and just got overcome by the fumes himself and drowned in the bottom of the tank in a little bit of water.
And that was not the first time. I mean, we don't have to go into every incident, although they're all really interesting stories, but your father had a history of putting himself on the line, even in the military, to save other people that he didn't know.
Yeah, some type of post or something in some type of military exercise, it fell, and he pushed the gentleman out of the way, the other soldier out of the way, and it hit him full in the back, and that's how he got discharged from the Army.
So I wonder what your thoughts were when you heard about Shannon's death. Were you surprised that he'd given his life?
Well, after the initial shock, it's like I lost my right arm, but after I got over the initial shock, my wife and I were laying in bed and were just kind of praying together, and we both just looked at each other and said, you know he saved somebody. You know he probably went after the shooter. That's just the way Shannon is. He's fiercely protective, and that's just the way Shannon was.
Before you even knew what had happened to Shannon, you assumed he'd done something heroic, and that's how he died.
Yes. Yeah, that's just the way Shannon is. Our prayers were answered the next day. Denise's sister posted on Facebook, and the rest, you know, it's all well documented about what happened there.
So help me kind of grapple with this question that we have today, which is, what makes someone choose to do that? We spend so much time trying to figure out the minds of sociopaths or murderers or people who commit horrific acts. But I want to understand the mind of someone like your father or Shannon. What makes someone make that choice?
I think it's just that's just what they do. I mean, it's what they know. That they just try to be the best person they can be and take care of others at all costs. I mean, I think that's just the way they were built. I think it comes from my paternal grandparents. I think they instilled a lot of those values in both of them. And Shannon really looked up to our dad. That was our hero. And Shannon was my personal protector. No one could get near me, Celeste. And everywhere we went, I felt totally protected because Shannon had me. But that's gone. But I still have them. I mean, they're still my personal protectors. They're just in another spot now. They're up in heaven. But on their gravestones, we have John 15:13, greater love hath no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. And that's on both my dad and my brother's gravestones. I think that's what it is in a nutshell. We just need to learn to love each other more, you know? I mean, it's crazy what's going on out there. But as protectors and my loved ones, I'm just so proud of them. You know, I could talk about them all day. There's just so many stories. Near and dear to my heart now is my wife is a breast cancer survivor, and she's my current hero. And just how strong she is each and every day, how she's preparing for this. We're just trying to get her ready for this, and I just wish everyone listening would just send out their prayers to my wife, Beth.
How do you then understand the actions that others take when you look at things like the two men who died protecting or intervening on behalf of two women and were stabbed because of it? Does it give you, I guess, a better understanding of why they chose to do that?
No, not really. I mean, Shannon would protect anyone. He'd give the shirt off his back. My dad was, I was told, was the same way. They were very life of the party. Everyone felt they were their best friends. They were always the protectors, always very fierce, always very, they're very tough guys too now. They're very, very tough.
And you had contact with the woman that Shannon saved.
Yeah, Denise, she's really sweet, and she was had gotten married, and she and her husband, they just had a baby, and they named their daughter after Shannon.
But she was afraid. Reportedly, she was afraid to have contact with you and your family because she thought you'd be angry.
Huh. I don't know. I don't remember hearing that she was afraid to contact us. We might be angry. When she came to the funeral. We embraced her, and we just loved her and embraced her, and we appreciated that she was there.
That is Rob Johnson of Gray, Georgia. He's the brother of Shannon Johnson, who died in the San Bernardino shooting a year and a half ago this month. Rob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
To maybe get a little further into this question of whether heroes are born or made, Zeno Franco joins us now. He looks at the psychology of heroics. He's assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Zeno, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What did you hear there? Anything surprising? He was repeating over, that's just the way they were. Is that what you hear?
Sure. I think, you know, one of the things when we first started looking at this from a kind of a research lens, what makes people act heroically, we heard time and time again people just say, well, I did something heroic because I needed to. I had to. It was the thing that I needed to do to fulfill my role. And we just kind of felt like, well, they're kind of being overly humble in some way. As we've thought more and more about it, I think one of the things we've recognized is that oftentimes heroes are really just in that moment taking the next right action. And they're not thinking about, am I going to be a hero? Am I doing something that's going to be recognized by my community as something, you know, super important? They just do the next right thing. And so that's one of the things that I certainly hear there.
So let me play you a couple clips, because we actually went out and talked to people in Atlanta about what being a hero means. The first one, he's talking more about an everyday hero.
Sure. My name is Terrell Benbury. I live in East Atlanta. Have I done anything heroic? Done a lot of things heroic. Taking care of my son on my own. Can't give up. That's your bloodline. I mean, you know what I mean? If he eat before I eat, then I had a happy day, then that makes me a hero that day, you know what I mean? Because as long as he eat, then I'm good.
That's one definition, and here's another one.
Mary Ann McFarlane. I live in Conyers, Georgia, And I'm retired, a retired school teacher. A hero would be somebody that does something extraordinary that most people would not do to help other people.
And that's different than your sort of everyday hero, right? One is an extraordinary act that, say, 90% of the population would not do. One is being strong and resilient in the face of sort of life's challenges. So which definition do you use for research?
So I think we're looking at all aspects of it. I think one of the things that happened initially in this work is sort of thinking about heroes as what we call a heroic elect, that there can only be a very few number of people that sort of meet this high bar for taking risks and responding effectively in a crisis situation. The reality is that probably everyone can act heroically. Maybe not every single person, but almost every person can do something that is heroic in some degree in their life. And we actually have some research evidence for that, too. So there was a large national random sample study that was done by one of my mentors, Dr. Phil Zimbardo, and a team that he works with in California. And they found that actually 20 to 25% of random sample taken, people say, you know, yes, I have done something heroic in my past. And what's interesting about that, too, is that it often we found that minorities were folks that were reporting that they had to act heroically more often, maybe because they were in some complex situations in an urban environment or whatever. So, you know, we think that more people than not encounter situations where they can act heroically. Some people maybe are afraid to, but it's really something that's available to all of us.
But what about that moment? How many people, when they make that decision, know that their life might be on the line? And I ask that because I bet the situation in which intervening to stop someone from harassing a couple young women in most cases would not end up costing someone their life, right? I mean, you don't know that when you intervene.
You don't all the way. You may not know what the outcome is, but I think a lot of, I mean, when you're encountering somebody, you know, with a weapon, and you decide to step forward, there's a lot on the line. And I think one of the things that I talk about is the heroic stance, right? You may or may not be a hero in the end, but you're approaching the situation from the perspective of, I'm willing to engage with this risk. And this is where sort of the more serious heroics comes in, right? Not what you're talking about as everyday heroism, but sort of this risk-based heroism. And it is a big choice. And one of the things that we've also found, there's a graduate student at Claremont Graduate University, Brian Riches, who talks about some research that he's done looking at prudence in heroes. And so one of the things that we've been finding from his work is that many heroes that do take physical risk are probably evaluating that risk rapidly. They're making a very quick decision to engage, but they do think that they can surmount the risk. At the same time, though, they are willing to accept the consequences. And I think that transcendence of one's own life to put your life on the line is a huge statement about what kind of potential humans have to care for one another.
So then we come to the essential question, which is there a psychological profile of a hero, and can it be developed?
Sure. We don't know if there's a psychological profile yet. I think that's one of the questions that has been being started to be asked over the last decade or so as the sort of science around heroics has kind of gotten into fuller gear. We spent the last century really talking about the social psychology of evil without really thinking about sort of the flip side of the coin, and that's where we are now. So there's about a decade of research on this at this point in time. I think some of the pieces are, you know, what came up with what Rob talking about his brother Shannon, you know, the sort of grit, toughness, physical robustness, some other pieces that may be genetically predetermined to a little, you know, to some degree, 20 or 30% perhaps, maybe things like risk-taking proclivity, right? So some people are less inclined to take a risk than others. But I think if a person is forced to really encounter a situation that is dangerous, at some point in time, even people that don't want to engage with risk will have to step up to the plate and often do. So is there a particular profile? No. We do think there are some predispositions for risk-taking for sort of this robustness. Also, probably some people are just more aware of situations, right? So if you're sitting there on your cell phone and you're not looking at the entire situation, you don't see a crisis unfolding, you're not able to respond effectively. Other people are kind of taking in the whole situation. And that's something we call situational awareness.
But then in terms of heroism and in terms of developing or sponsoring it, what we just heard was a man talking about an entire family where that kind of sacrifice was encouraged and modeled. And that brings us back to the nature or nurture, which it sounds like we don't have an answer to which is more powerful, right?
In all of these things, I think it's always both, right? So if you look at some of the research on the genetics of risk-taking behavior, probably 20 to 30% of that is genetically controlled. There's a big study in Nature Neuroscience in 2005. I believe the author was Mary Jean Creek, a very famous researcher. And she found that about 20 to 30% of risk-taking behavior is probably genetically controlled. The other part is probably nurture, right? It's probably exactly those sort of familial things that Rob was talking about with his father and probably his grandparents passing down a set of ideals. And this is, for me, perhaps the most compelling piece is it is what we teach, right? In combination with a child's sort of natural born qualities that is going to impart the sort of heroic perspective. And I think without that training, without imparting that ideal, it's difficult to have people kind of step over into that space.
So in the minute that we have left, Zeno, are there more heroes among humankind than villains?
It's always a struggle, right? It's always a struggle. And I think we are at a turning point in society. We've been dealing with the scourge of terrorism for the last decade. And we really have to think in our local communities, in our churches, in our mosques, in every part of our society, do we want villainy to win, or do we want to impart these ideals of heroic action and response to crises that effectively bring out the best in humanity? And I think that that is our goal over the next few years. That's what we as individuals must do.
Zeno Franco is an assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Zeno, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's a show for today, but we really need to hear from you. We want to hear about a time that you or someone you know did something heroic. Call and tell us the story at 404-500-9457, post it on Facebook or on Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.